You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is back open for live shows, classes, and customized corporate workshops and events. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. For more information, go to secondcity.com. The Second City is excited to work with Amazon as part of their new and exciting app called AMP. AMP is a home where anyone can create live radio-style shows alongside some of the biggest names in the entertainment industry, including ours. Join the Second City live every Thursday at 5 p.m. Central Time for our show, Second City Public Radio. SCPR is an interactive weekly lampoon of all things public radio. Each week, our host and an ever-expanding panel of Second City characters open up the lines to listeners from around the U.S. to ask questions and offer us opinions on a slew of wide-reaching subjects. Download the app and don't forget to tune in, AMP, Thursdays at 5 p.m. Central Time.
So this was a fun conversation. I'm talking to Tara Schuster, who is an author, playwright, and accomplished entertainment executive. She actually served as vice president of talent and development of Comedy Central, where she was the executive in charge of a bunch of shows featuring Second City alums, including the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning Key and Peele with Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele, and Detroiters with Tim Robinson and Sam Richardson. She is the author of two books that we talk about, Buy Yourself the Effing Lilies and Glow in the Effing Dark. I think you're going to enjoy this show. Trigger warning, we do talk about suicide and mental health and a lot of her struggles and, you know, all our struggles. Enjoy the pod. It's a good one.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Tara Schuster, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the first question on this podcast usually attempts to set the table for one of two things. It's either the origin story that is the reason we're talking to you today. In your case, that could take up the entire podcast. Or a central truth that I think I gleaned from reading your work. And having read both your books, I can't help but go back to a phrase that came to me after a couple decades of working at the helm of the Second City. And that phrase is, nobody got into comedy because they're well-adjusted. Does that say anything or speak to you in any way?
Yeah, it definitely rings true, particularly around, you know, so much of comedy is telling stories that are like a little more extreme, but contain a universal truth that everyone can relate to. And so those of us who have had experiences at the extremities, I think, are the ones who can tell those stories the best. But I also want to say that I don't think that the archetype of the suffering artist who's just struggling and everything's hard. I really reject that. And I don't think you need to be depressed or drink or have a million issues in order to be funny. I just think, yeah, perhaps some of us have more detailed stories to tell.
So I have two responses to that. One is, as I've gotten older, I realized, well, that's a funny little quip for me to say to some sort of person writing a story about Second City. As I've gotten older, I don't think anyone exists in this world who is necessarily well-adjusted. That's, I think. But even, I remember Mark Maron came here to do a talk. I think he had a book or something out. And he said, you know, because the pictures at Second City, when you come in are chronological. And so you're looking at the black and white ones. And you're like, oh, and Mark in particular was like, Belushi died for his art. And, you know, Farley died for his art. And then he's looking at the picture. He's like, oh, Stephen Colbert kind of got his shit together. Steve Carell, he's got his stuff together. Tina Fey, yeah, Amy Poehler. And he had this epiphany at that moment of like, no, it's not about burning yourself out, which was very much for me coming, starting here in the late 80s and, you know, and then producing in the early 90s and through the 2000s. That was very prevalent until that generation came in where it was like, no, Tina doesn't drink pot. And she's very funny.
Yeah, I definitely, it's important to me to talk to other writers about, you don't have to be messed up to be good at your craft. In fact, you know, those old things of like Hemingway drank and, you know, that's how he got to his glory. I'm like, Hemingway also committed suicide. Like, I'm not trying to do that. I'm just trying to lead a healthy life simply because it makes me happier. And actually, I think it makes the writing crisper and clearer when I'm not so dissociated from my mood that I can't even tell like what's true and what's not true. I want I'm like more in control.
That's right. So I want to focus mostly on your new book, but I think it's worth a little bit of time to focus on your first book. And I love how you open that book, which adheres to a narrative rule that we teach at Second City, which is start in the middle. So it's the day after your 25th birthday, and you wake up at 3 p.m., still in your fancy clothes from the night before, and you have a series of messages waiting for you. Can you tell us about that particular
moment? Well, first of all, it was not a fancy outfit. It was straight from Forever 21, and it was so synthetic that I could have burst into flames at any moment.
Not good.
But I woke up on top of my bed, fully clothed, and I start listening to these voicemails from my therapist. And I realized that the night before, she was calling me to find out where I was because I had drunk dialed her and threatened to take my life. And she was so freaked out. And she was like a very calm European woman who mostly in sessions always had like a little mug with the tea bag and the little string coming about it and a kerchief around her neck. She was freaked out. Yeah. And so to hear how scared she was in the messages really scared me into realizing I didn't have parents growing up. Really, I didn't have parents who nurtured me. They were incapable of taking care of children. This had led me to have severe anxiety and depression. And if I didn't do something to save my life, I wouldn't have much of a life to live. So that's where my first book begins.
And then the new book does open with you careening down Highway 40 in the Mojave Desert screaming, "What is happening to me?" So,
Yeah,
it's symmetry. I mean, life's a journey, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
No.
Sorry, what were you gonna say?
Yeah, no, I was thinking about this because, you know, I read the books back to back and I don't often do that in terms of, and actually your publicist was great about that because she knows I read all the books. She's like, read both.
Awesome.
And it was interesting. And what I sort of enjoyed about both those is, you know, the first book, yeah, things are a mess, but you're coming to terms with them and you're dealing with it. And you're while not necessarily getting closure, you're getting close to some sort of, you know, and we all have this in some degree, which is why I think people respond to your work. But in particular, you have that really lovely ability to, you write very well, but you also, you know, you're a sympathetic mess in regard to this. And with the second book, what I enjoyed about it is you really journey a little farther into, okay, what is my trauma? What's the name for it? And how does this tie up with maybe some reading I'm doing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction or philosophy? And like you're sort of revealing yourself to maybe be capable of going a lot deeper into this, which then I think makes you an empathetic character for others to look at and be like, look, like she kind of got it together and she had a lot of stuff against her. But also it's not like you're asking for that. It just sort of is there.
That's nice to know. That's nice to know from the reader perspective. Mm-hmm. I'll take that empathy.
Yeah.
And you take whatever I can get.
Yeah. And you have a line in the book that I really like early on, which is, quote, "If you're not dealing with the thing you know you need to deal with, it's dealing with you."
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the second book really is, as you said, it's diving deeper. So the first book, is basically I figure out all these rituals to reparent myself, to get me to stability, to a enjoyable life where I'm not walking around the streets thinking I'm worthless, nobody loves me, I'm ugly 24/7 times 7 days a week. Mm. And I really got there. I got to a happy-ish, like, you know, stable, which stable was really like the key to all this, person I liked. And like the moment I did that, I realized, oh my God, my life up until now has been a reaction to trauma. I've just been playing emotional whack-a-mole and filling in the gaps for all these things that happened. Who am I? Who is essential me? Who would I be if somebody else wasn't defining me, if my trauma wasn't defining me? And it was actually getting laid off from Comedy Central that sort of set that journey into motion. You know, if I had stayed at, if I had never been laid off, I don't know that this book would have happened, because I had used that job as a magic trick. Mm-hmm. You know, like, look at me, I'm working with Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele and David Spade, and I'm like glamorous and I went to the Emmys, you know, look over here. Don't look over here at this quarter century of complex trauma that's like keeping you up at night. It was such a the duality there. And once I lost my identity as, I mean, just for example, people would introduce me like Tara Schuster, Comedy Central, like it was my married last name, right. You know, I worked there a third of my life.
Right.
So I just had no sense of self. And that's why I went on this journey, was because I lost it when I lost that job. You know, the thing that I thought redeemed my childhood, when that was taken away from me, I did not know who I was.
So you and I have both gone through trauma therapy. So I thought that this could be kind of interesting. And I remember very much starting with sort of breathing exercises.
Yeah.
But then we ventured into EMDR.
Oh, nice.
Which was amazing.
Yeah.
And
the real deal.
It's the real deal. And as I've talked to different people, it's amazing how many people have gone through that, who then recognize, you know, and I think this, and I'm still on this journey, but what's been fascinating, your book landed within, it's not like I plot the order of these things, you know, and I don't normally go after the folks for the podcast, because the publicists all know me and send me stuff. So my last one was a former economist, who now deals in healing and mostly family trauma, but not necessarily immediate family trauma from like 4 or 5 generations back.
Yeah, right.
And she was amazing. And it was, you know, but a lot of these folks end up, and I'm reading a book by Sarah Rose Kavanaugh. Actually, you'd love this. She's an educator and she's dealing with mental health for kids, basically like 16 to 24.
Wow.
But a lot of it, and it's called Mind Over Monsters, because of all the monster mythology, has to do with things that are wrong with the body. So this, and that was a thing that I just never, mind body, sure, I actually understood the words and the ideas, but until you do something like EMDR, where you really are trying to sync up what's going on in here that's informing up here, and I'm touching my body and pointing to my head. And it feels like you also had, like, you have body stuff that you had to deal with, but all of that is of a piece and of a thing.
Yeah. You know, one thing I really hope to do with this book is something like EMDR, which is, I forget, and I always forget what it stands for, but for someone who's never done it, it sounds like magic / snake oil salesman, charlatan, step into my tent, like, of healing. Sounds completely fake, because basically they use bilateral stimulation, which means you'd either, for me, I would move my eyes from side to side to the sound of a metronome, and a therapist would guide me on a journey to heal the actual trauma, which is completely different from insight-based therapy. Like, if you've had talk therapy, you know, you're talking about it, you're looking for patterns. But why I really wanted to get EMDR out there more is because it's just, to me, a way more effective way to deal with trauma, and recognizing that there are different kinds of therapies, that if talk therapy is not working for you, you might try EMDR. You might try this other thing called internal family systems. Mm-hmm. And in my book, I just try to break it down because these things sound insane. They sound, oh, wow. and they sound fake, but actually EMDR is recommended by like the Department of Defense for
very scientifically sound.
It just sounds crazy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think the biggest thing for me was realizing that I didn't even need to know the story around things. I simply needed to heal the trauma. And the trauma is not the event. It's how you respond to something,
right.
How something happens. And then Gabor Mate, who's, kind of the father of trauma and tons of great books, he talks about it as it's what that event made you believe about yourself and how you acted, how you coped from then on. Because a lot of us have the coping mechanisms of our five-year-old selves. And my five-year-old self was awesome and glittery and loved to dress up. But like, I'm not looking to her for relationship advice. You know, like she should not be the driver of really any decision other than what should I wear tonight? So, there are all these different things available. And I really try to break it down and even give you tools that are free that you don't have to have a lot of money to use.
Yeah. I mean, Bessel van der Kolk's work, In Body Keeps the Score, which is like still on the bestseller list. And I was actually when I got to the end of that book and he talks about work that he's done in improvisation, which kind of makes sense when that's embodied. It's embodied presence and you're with that with someone else. So I'm like, oh, no, that actually, jives. There are so many terrible and hilarious stories. I would love you to relate. You went to Bryce Canyon on a trip.
Oh, God. Yes.
And this is what I relate this to, because I think it comes in the same chapter, which is like you talk about like your house being built on an unstable foundation. And you don't just mean that metaphorically.
No, I mean it actual mudslide endangered. They had to build, like, I knew the word pylon when I was six because they all had to be new pylons had to be put into the center of the earth. The house was an open construction site for 5 years due to a hasty remodel, which, they tore open all the walls, the ceilings, and then realized, wait, we don't have any of the permits. And then just like kept it that way. So I grew up in a dangerous, actually dangerous house. And I don't remember why we're talking about that dangerous house.
Yeah, well, and then you... You hooked up with in the pandemic with a guy named Charles, actually, like, I think it was online, right? And then, and he wanted to take you on this trip to Bryce Canyon.
Yeah.
Which then I think becomes kind of that trip also becomes a bit of a metaphor for the house and how that's
going
into adult life.
Yeah. Well, that whole chapter. So basically, I had grown up with a sense of no safety because the house wasn't safe. My parents were constantly fighting. And I mean, 10 out of 10 vicious fog of war, there will be no survivors kind of fighting, screaming, telling me about financial insecurity. I didn't feel safe. And I didn't even realize that safety was a thing until I was at lunch in Zion. Actually, I was camping and I went to get takeout food and I overheard this father talking to his children about canyoneering. And he said, I've never been canyoneering before and it might be scary, but I've hired an expert to keep you safe. So even when you're scared, you're going to be safe. And I was like, mind blown. Oh my God. Safety is a thing. You don't have to be 10 out of 10 scared. You don't have to jump when the trash can lid is put on. I hadn't even realized how jumpy I was. And so because I never valued my safety, I went basically with someone I did not know to Bryce Canyon. And immediately upon getting there, his brother, who was also there, took me on a walk through the hoodoos, which are amazing. They're like giant totem poles made of sand, naturally occurring. And we're going on this walk and, just getting to know you. Hi, I'm Tara. Blah, blah, blah. And he says, you want to know something crazy? I'm like, sure. He's like, I escaped a sex cult And there were things I did in Mexico that I really regret. And I'm like, whoa. Unsafe.
Right.
And then he continues, you want to know something crazier? I'm like, no, I really don't. And he says, Charles was in it too. And Charles was the guy I was with and currently sharing a camper van with. And rather than figure out a way to get myself out of there, because it turned out to be Nexium, which I knew enough at the time to know there was already a documentary out about it. Right. And though I don't know if he was exaggerating the sex cult part. I don't know. But once people are talking about escaping sex cults, you probably don't want to be with them alone in Bryce Canyon.
Yep.
Instead of doing anything to help myself, I pounded some whiskey and then went on a run in the dark because running is like how I get anxious feelings out of my body. So I was like, I know. Yeah, this is great self-care. Like the booze is going to keep me warm and the running. I'm just going to pause because there's really, can you hear that? Crazy sirens.
Nope.
Oh, great. So I just thought, you know, the booze is going to warm me up in the running. That's great self-care. Instead of finding a ranger, walking out of the park, doing anything to protect myself. And one of the major lessons I learned is that we all need a sense of safety, particularly because the world is actually pretty unsafe. And so if you don't have some safety inside of you, you're just in a slingshot. You are at the whim of all external conditions, which, like, I don't know if anyone's read the news recently, but it's a shit show out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a big wake up call that I needed safety.
So it's interesting because pretty soon in chapters following that, you quote Annie Dillard, "How we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives." And this becomes a sort of a turning point as you start to realize, like, all right, everything is messed up. There is no changing the past. There is no changing the present. You know, all you can be in control of is your emotional response to these things.
Yeah.
And there is the intellectual understanding of that, which probably came first.
Right.
Because then it's what becomes, and this is the for myself, The magic trick I don't even understand about when I was able to, and this was only like in therapy like 3 weeks ago, was I'm like, my feet, I don't know why my feet are on the ground and they feel solid. But right now I'm not afraid.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid and I feel solid. And she's just like, my therapist is like, can we just take a moment and like be good with that? And
I'm like,
yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like you had that a bit where it was like, yeah, this is all this stuff. I need to let myself off the hook. And I need to do and just do as best as I can.
Yeah, it's funny. The self-healing journey, and I make a claim in the book that I can help you recover your soul, which is quite the claim to be making.
Yeah.
And I do it because it really is possible with little teeny baby steps done. Like once you intellectually understand, okay, the trauma happened. I might not be to blame, but now no matter what, it actually is my responsibility. Sucks that it happened and I have to own it 1000% and do everything I can to heal it. Once you understand that, there are so many tools you can use to employ to have a new reaction. You know, so what I'm not saying in this book that I talk a lot about anxiety. And much darker things, suicidal ideation, my lifelong battle with depression. I am not saying that we can be fully cured and you'll never feel anxious again. What I'm saying is we can feel anxious, pause, dig into whatever that emotion is, and choose a new reaction. So that we're not completely overwhelmed all the time. And that's what all of the tools in my book are meant to do is shortcuts to how do we train ourselves to have new reactions.
Was the Bryce Canyon trip a kind could would that have been some level of exposure therapy for you?
I don't actually know what exposure therapy is.
So exposure therapy is when you have got a particular kind of fear, the really one of the only ways to combat that fear is to get close to it. And a lot of times it's simulated. So if you're afraid of spiders, it's like there's a spider in the other room.
Yeah.
And so I wondered if in this sort of self-medicating world, it was sort of like, I'm going to go do this thing.
No, I don't think so. No. I think it was just a reckless, I don't even know that I should be safe. Let's go. I do not give myself any credit for making that decision. It was one in a million of bad decisions.
All right. Well, then let's point out something that I think is healthy that you, and you alluded to it earlier, which is a company is not your family. You say that in your book.
And yeah.
I work at Second City. I've worked here 34 years. Like, and I'm so identified, Kelly Leonard, Second City, that is, but you know, I certainly know after all, it's like, you know, it's been around 65 years, so it's going to go on after me. It went on before me.
Yeah.
And if I keep that, if that is what is responsible for my identity as a human being, it's just going to fall short.
Yeah. It's dangerous because once you identify as something other than what's inside of you, you are at the mercy of external circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You have given over all of your self-esteem, your confidence, how you relate to yourself to somebody else. Because, you know, at Comedy Central, I started as an intern at The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. I ended as vice president of talent development, where I oversaw David Spade's show and Key and Peele and a bunch of other comedies I was obsessed with. And I had such strong relationships. I would go as far as to say I was beloved by my colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
And they laid me off so quickly that like my head spun, you know?
Yeah.
These places, they're businesses.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, it's a business. And the business, the goal of the business is to make money. And so unless your family is a hierarchical money-making machine, to talk about where you work as if it is your family, in my experience, it was deeply problematic.
Yep.
Because I was looking for things that a family would give me at work that just could never be so. And there have actually been a lot of studies, I'm citing Adam Grant here, about mm-hmm. how people who reveal too much or anything really personal actually suffer consequences. They are less likely to get promotions. They're less likely to get raises. And I know that it's super hip and in HR right now to be like, bring your most authentic self to work. You can be whoever you are. No, like, where is that true in an actual office? If you have that office, you are one of the very few. It is actually much more likely that the people there do not know how to cope with whatever you're coping with because that's not their job. They did not do the 6,000 hours of therapy training that a therapist in California would have to do. They're doing their best. And now how I see it is your colleagues, I think of more as like mission control, like we're going on a mission to Mars and everybody has to have really specific roles. Everyone relies on each other. But when you've got a mission to Mars, oh my God, that's the most important thing. You cannot get distracted by gossip. I mean, lives are on the line. You have to be really focused. And that's really much more how I see it. And it's interesting how many people talk about work like a family.
Yeah.
And I just now completely, I feel like I have found a much healthier way of thinking about it.
Yeah. I've had that conversation with Adam, who's a friend.
Really?
Yeah. Part because there's good research around what we're talking about, self-disclosure, about you sort of revealing information about yourself, which actually in very moderate doses is really useful with regard to, I can talk to you about the fact that I have a Bernese Mountain Dog, and that might mean something, like, and it does to people who are into dogs, you know, that is, and that's good. Like, you know, but then what people have to understand is like, as you sort of elevate that, it gets more complex and complicated because, as you point out, like humans, not every human knows how to deal with this stuff, especially with the messy, you know?
No.
And I do, you know, I'm like, I work at a theater. You can imagine what.
Yeah. Theater, different.
A comedy theater. Yeah. It's different. But still unhealthy boundaries and barriers all over the place. So how do we make that work well? And that takes a lot of patience, empathy, and people who are well adjusted. And that's just not like the population.
No, and period. My best advice for this is I act like a professional.
Yeah.
Whatever situation I'm in, let's say with my publisher right now, sometimes, you know, when you write two books about the worst moments of your life, there are going to be some tears. People are going to see these tears. And I don't, you know, I don't reprimand myself for sometimes having a total meltdown. And most of the time I try to act like, well, how would a professional, somebody who this is my job, I am so passionate about it, but I don't need everybody around me here to coddle me or make me feel good about me. And my self-esteem isn't coming from this. Because again, the moment you start fixing yourself to your job or an identity that somebody can take away from you, you're in trouble. You're just set up for disaster.
Yeah. Okay. So one thing that just exists no matter what is your family. And
yeah.
And you talk about your dad a lot and, you know, not even close to a perfect relationship, but the one that you sort of like kept. I was not expecting in the second book to then have you stopped talking to him for like a while.
2 years.
Two years.
Yeah.
So talk about, because look, you invested like so much in that and it kind of paid off a little bit, but what was the thing? Okay. That this is the I'm stopping. And then tell a little bit about how you re-entered that mode of communication.
Yeah. So for my whole life, so my parents split us up. I have a little sister and my sister went with my mom.
Worst, by the way, I can't.
Yeah.
I
didn't like it either. And no. I went with my dad and there was never ever like, how are the children going to see each other? And to see my sister, I'd have to barter with my mom who was super psychologically abusive. And it was a total mess. And yeah. So my dad was really the only parent. He was the only adult. And he really didn't have the life skills to be present with me ever. Like if you were to ask my dad right now, what was your thought about Tara growing up? He would say, and he has said to me, I didn't know she was there. I wasn't hugged. I wasn't told you're proud of you. I couldn't have needs. If I cried, I was told not to. And the cumulative effect was a part of the anxiety and depression, you know, do that like 1 million times. And there are real results. And so right when COVID started, I just knew that I had to do some deeper work. And that if my dad was in my life, I wouldn't be able to, because he constantly triggered all these patterns, all these trauma responses that I was trying to heal. And I just told him, I said, I love you. And I need to take a pause in this relationship because I need to heal myself. This is not, I don't hate you. In fact, I love you. And that was that. And so 2 years later, he got COVID. Mm-hmm. And you know, the moment I found out he had COVID, I was whatever differences we have, I'm going to go help him. And what I found out was shocking. It was that he had been in therapy for the previous 2 years, trying to answer the question, why is my daughter not speaking to me?
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost as if a completely new dad walked into my life, to the extent that we call the old dad, dad one, and the new dad, dad two.
Mm-hmm.
Because dad two apologizes for things, tells me he's proud of me, has tried to hug me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's remarkable. And I write about it, and I hesitated to write about it because what I don't want the message to be is if you draw a boundary, someone else will change. That's super rare that someone actually But what I am saying is my dad is 78 and has made unbelievable progress. He has changed and is so much happier than he ever was.
Mm.
And, you know, for me, there's a lot of grief there, you know, grief that he's old, you know, and I might not have much time with him. But there's so much gratitude because I never thought I would have someone who supported me. I never thought I'd have like a dad, like a real dad. Mm-hmm. And he's not perfect at it. In fact, we are in quite a tiff right now. We do family therapy together.
Yeah.
It's a mess in this exact moment. Yep. And the fact he's in therapy trying to work this stuff out with me and trying to be a better person, there's so much to be grateful for. And that's been one of my big takeaways, is that grief and gratitude go hand in hand. Right. And if you focus solely on the grief and the negative things in your life, you're actually not seeing reality. You are not seeing the big picture. And the only way to see reality is to hand in hand marry grief and gratitude. The terrible things, the beautiful things, the joy, the sorrow, they're all like one, essentially. And it's helpful because that really opens the aperture of your whole life. You know, it gives you perspective.
There's no joy without suffering. I mean, this is the basis of Eastern traditions and indigenous traditions. EMDR, also indigenous, a lot of taking from there. It's interesting. My wife and I often say we have a 25-year-old son. We're like, there's no manual for parenting an adult child. So and believe me, my wife read every single book.
Yeah, right.
Every book. And for both of our kids, that was something that was, you know, all right, we did the best we can. And now it's sort of like, okay, how are we managing this with Nick? And I don't know, jury's out.
Yeah.
We just text each other. He wants me to watch The Last of Us. He said the last episode was amazing. So, you know.
Yeah.
We'll jump on that. And we talked about this before we started taping, that the last question is about a yes and I forgot that I had written down two of those things that you write about in your book that might be a jumping off spot. And of course, but you asked this question of yourself: when did I feel the most yes in my life? Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
And then you talk about this. You haven't read the book, which I love that you say that. Scott Shute, there's a book called The Full Body Yes: Change Your Work and Your World from Inside Out.
Yeah.
Which I made a note of because I'm going to like get it. But both of those things come sort of at the end. And you have a line too, which I love, which is, future me is the highest version of myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. I mean, that is so aspirational, but also like it gives you that horizon that you are able to see.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people, I had Sanford Greenberg, who was not born blind, but he became blind when he was in college. He's quite old now, but he said one of the interesting things about blind people is they don't see horizons. And they also have to have incredible trust.
Yeah, right. Totally.
And he said that in his life, maybe three people have betrayed that trust. I'm like, that seems pretty good.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, I think for me, my yes and would be this whole turning from an executive to a writer is a yes and. Mm-hmm. You know, I was really scared to do it. I thought it would be a career ender because nobody would ever hire me again as an executive because I'd shared so much, and then the book wouldn't be successful enough for me to make it a career. And I had to say, like, okay, yes, all those fears exist, and this is how I feel most alive. I feel my absolute best when I am writing, and that's not when I'm selling books. It's when I'm in process. Mm-hmm. I feel 100. I feel like I'm connected to something much bigger than me, like an animating force of the universe. I also feel that when I'm running. Those are the two instances where I have this full body yes. And that never has let me down. That these fears that I had were ridiculous, because basically after the first book came out, a headhunter tried to get me to take an executive job. And then the book has only led to a second book. Mm-hmm. So all these fears that were like holding me back, what I realized is, no, I need to trust myself and step more into like what the yes, like, what makes me come alive?
Yeah, because if you're really, and this is why we say yes and, because it's more than just the yes. It's like what lay beyond. And I know this from when I wrote my book, which, like, I did this. Like, it was an amazing accomplishment. And it led to a whole bunch, like, my whole life changed and my career changed. And I went from all improv on stage, just like that work, which you're very familiar with. And then I have just been working with academics and other people about improv off stage and how it can, you know, help people in their caregiving and help people who are on the autism spectrum and help retirees and all this work, which is like full of meaning and purpose, which is then you recognize is like, oh, that's the reason I did the other work and what was meaningful for me. Again, like, I just remember young Keegan at Second City Detroit, this kid who just wanted to do this work and sitting down in the audience and being like, oh, he's got it. Like, yeah. I just, like, I knew, and he didn't even quite know it. And he comes to Chicago and then blows up, of course. Mm-hmm. And he was here. He's part of our artistic advisory board now. And he was probably like 2-3 months ago. It's like him and Sam Richardson, Tim Meadows.
I love them.
Oh, yeah. It was all those guys. And they all came and saw the show. And they were just so happy in terms of, like, this was where they started. And they're talking to the artists about, like, I remember Keegan went backstage. He's like, you recognize that you own what you do. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, none of this matters. What this is going on, what happened tonight is great. And you could just see them being like, oh, like,
yeah.
And so I think that you are now in this place where you can give back. And I'm sure this is your audience, right? To young people who are going through the same sort of like, what am I going to do? Where am I going to be?
Oh, yeah.
So this is, and especially as a young woman, because there's not, you know, as many of those sort of models out there for saying do this. So I don't know. I just think it's very powerful, and your writing's really good.
And
so, like,
thank you.
Keep doing.
Yeah, it's interesting because my readership is, the ages are all over the map. It's because it's timeless. We, like, if you're 78 and have not dealt with your trauma, you are the same as me at 25. There's really not much of a difference, and so. What I ultimately hope I give people is a somewhat funny, relatable plan for emotional freedom.
Because
you really, you can be liberated from a lot of this stuff. It is not, and it's not like a stroke of genius or magic from God. It's like, take some steps, make some habits, do it a bunch of times equals emotional freedom. And that's the path I'm on. I've gotten a lot of it. I'm not at the end. I think if you're at the end, you're probably dead. But that's the journey I want to invite people to take with me.
The books are called Buy Yourself the Effing Lilies and Glow in the Effing Dark. Tara Schuster, thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
The Getting the Yes And podcast is produced by The Second City and WGN Radio. We are supported at The Second City by Mike Farinaccio and Colleen Fahey. Our show is produced by Andrew Harris at WGN. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of the podcast is by Jukebox The Ghost. If you're interested in knowing more about The Second City, you can log on to secondcity.com or email us at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.